You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. Good to be alone with you again, meaning I'm solo, coming to you from Gdańsk. It's in northern Poland, on the Baltic coast, at the mouth of the Vistula River, same river that runs through Warsaw, where we were a month before last. It also runs through Krakow, where we're headed next, and it's the longest river in Poland. You'll notice, with very few exceptions, that the major European cities, they all have a river running through it. And there's a reason for that, of course. Humans, before the advent of air travel, they congregated together and used rivers for the purpose of commerce and trade. Vegas wasn't a thing until air travel started in the 1920s. Well, that's not entirely true. Vegas was a thing. It was established in 1905. But let's say we probably wouldn't have heard of it if not for air travel. It was a tiny railroad town back in the day, and in the Mojave Desert, a one-horse town. Now you can't even find the crazy horse in Vegas because it's closed. What was once the most popular strip club in Vegas, controlled by the mob back in the 70s, they tore it down a few years ago in 2022. Stay tuned, gentlemen. I'm here to give you the education you want but don't need. That way, next time you're in the gentleman's club, you can share a fun fact between cigars and a cognac or something. Do you know why they call them gentlemen's clubs? It's because in the gentlemen's clubs of 18th, 19th century Britain, they had these exclusive private social clubs for wealthy fellas, so they could socialize and enjoy a more refined atmosphere, maybe with a cognac, an aforementioned cigar. In order to partake, you had to have a membership so that they could ensure privacy and decorum, that sort of thing. I haven't been to a gentleman's club since last week. I kid. So modern strip clubs borrowed the term gentleman's clubs. That's where it came from, to try to be classy and add some sophistication to it. Try to make them appear upscale and not so seedy or trashy. Although I don't know how you get around that when somebody named Sapphire, who is fully pierced and tatted up, approaches you with smoke breath asking if she can dance on your lap for $20. Which I imagine with inflation, like, what's Crystal with a K asking for a dance these days? Is it $50 a song? I don't know. But if you make it rain, she will be under the weather. Wheezy baby. Gotta work in a Wayne reference just about every episode. But would you want it any other way? If I were some podcaster from Locust Ridge, Tennessee, would you blame me for talking about Dolly Parton all the time? You wouldn't. Why did Dolly Parton come to mind? I don't know. But yeah, rebranding strip clubs as gentlemen's clubs is just an attempt to help its image in the community, help it appear a little more upscale and socially acceptable. But let's go back to Europe. So Will Durant wrote about The Lessons of History. That's the book, The Lessons of History. In the book, he wrote about how deeply geography influences humans, that if you live on the coast, you'll almost inevitably become an addict of the sea, that throughout history, your proximity to the sea would foster a strong attraction and dependence on the water. And he explained that coastal peoples tend to develop a close relationship with the sea, which has often led them to become skilled seafarers, let's say. Is that a word? Seafarers? I think so. And the example he used is the people of Great Britain. I knew there was a reason Britain was on the brain, so I had planned to talk about this, not strip clubs. But he said that Britain, being surrounded by ocean, is why they became the finest naval seamen. That's why they became the most powerful navy in the history of the world, because of this addiction to the sea. He said you can smell the ocean from nearly anywhere in Britain. And he used, well, he used Great Britain as an example of how geography shapes a nation's character and their historical destiny. Indeed, the Brits ruled the oceans for a lot of years. But big cities in Europe with a river, there's so many, like London, Paris, Amsterdam, Prague, Budapest, Vienna, and even those that don't, they're typically located on a coast. I'm thinking Reykjavik, Barcelona, Copenhagen, Denmark. It'd be tough to think of one that isn't. Sofia, Bulgaria. That's the capital of Bulgaria, Sofia. Maybe Athens, Greece, is inland. Speaking of Greece, I had a buddy who hit me up on Facebook last week and wanted to know what was the best part of Santorini to stay in. And I couldn't help him. I've never been. But I like that he thought of me, though. But just so you know, my beautiful listeners, I haven't been everywhere, but it is on my list, as the saying goes. Gdansk, where we are now, if you're curious, is way better than we expected. The wife and I deliberately did no research before we got here. Other than daycares for my little one, we have her enrolled in an international British daycare. What are the odds? Britain keeps coming up. But we could not have been more pleasantly surprised with Gdansk. The old town, as I call it, the old town. Thanks to my Czech friends, they call it the old town. The old town here is as good as any in Europe that I've been to. And what's happened in this Euro summer we're living is the spots just keep getting better and better. So Tallinn, Estonia, where I broadcasted to you from solo last time, was way better than Warsaw. And so far, Gdansk is just as good, if not better, than Tallinn. We were walking around the other day, and I turned to my wife and said, who thought to come here? And we don't know. We don't remember how we came up with the idea to visit Gdansk, which, for you history buffs, used to be called Danzig prior to World War II. It used to be part of Germany back in the Dizay. Another cool thing about here is the beaches are so nice. So earlier this week, we met up with a church group from the church my girls attended last Sunday, and they had a little pizza party near Sopot. And Sopot is part of the Tri-City area here with Gdynia. It's only like a 15-20 minute tram ride, so the public transit here is great. But the beach was so nice. There were so many people out. There are lots of cafes and bars, tree-lined paths, and just tons of people out jogging and riding their bikes. You don't see fat people here. We met some people visiting from Nebraska. The pastor of this group we met up with is from Dallas. He attended seminary in Denver, and he and his wife have lived here for 17 years. He'd never heard of it before he was assigned. I guess he was assigned here or asked to come. They've since had 4 kids here. He was playing the guitar, and they sat in a big circle and sang songs praising the Lord, and it was great. Although, if I'm being honest, I kind of hoped just once he'd break out in Wonderwall, but I didn't have it in me to make any requests since I was new to the group. I was actually laying on my back the whole time. I'm still having neck problems, but I go to the doctor here tomorrow. I went to a doctor in Tallinn and a physiotherapist, so I keep searching for a cure because it's weighing on me. You know, I have the same feeling here that I had when I first traveled to Romania, to the beaches of the Black Sea. It was like, whoa, they are keeping this a secret from us, we in the Western world. So I feel a little guilty talking about how wonderful it is here. So don't you tell anybody. What I share here stays between you and me. I don't want costs to go way up because Americans start taking Polish vacations and spending all their money here. Let's let our friends go where the migrants are, on the Thames or on the San. Those are the rivers that go through London and Paris, respectively. No migrants here, though. It's wonderful. I mean, it's so nice. Pay attention to my videos. I try to post them at least twice a week in my stories on Instagram and Facebook. The rivers aren't the only reason that cities in Europe flourished over the centuries. Their indented coastlines are a factor too. Europe has lots of ports, indented coastlines, Contrast that with Africa, which is still underdeveloped. One of the things you notice in Africa is there are very little indented coastlines. I visited the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, and as you look over the side of the cliff, there's a huge drop down to the ocean, and they have a bunch of signs up showing you all the shipwrecks that have happened there just off the coast. It gets real deep real quick, and the seas get pretty nasty. Their other problem in Africa is a lack of navigable waterways. So while Europe and China and America especially, America has the most naturally well-connected waterways of anywhere in the world. But those countries, or continents, in the case of Europe, were able to prosper and increase their standard of living largely due to their navigable waterways, which allowed for commerce and trade. Whereas Africa's rivers, one of which I almost drowned in, by the way, I did a whitewater rafting excursion on the Zambezi River, and I nearly drowned. And there was a big crocodile sunning on the deck when I finally got my head above water. If the river wasn't muddy before that, yeah, it is now. But let's talk about flow state, and then I'll get into some personal finance and investing stuff. What makes me want to talk about flow state today is I saw an article posted by Rob Henderson that said the largest predictor of flow states is the big five trait of conscientiousness, that flow state seems to emerge out of hard work and discipline, and in fact could be thought of as an internal reward for intense effort and focus on a single activity. In The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is my favorite audiobook, it's so good. In fact, I bought other audiobooks read by the same guy who reads The War of Art, because it's so good. He does such a good job. His name is George Goodall, G-U-I-D-A-L-L. I know Joe Rogan doesn't like when audiobooks aren't read by the author, but I disagree. Although sometimes they can be overacted, which makes them unenjoyable, in my opinion. I'm glad Pressfield didn't read his own book on this one, because it is so good. It's excellent. Anyway, in the book, Pressfield references a famous quote attributed to, his name is Somerset Maugham. He was an English novelist, which is how Pressfield got famous, by the way, writing a novel. He wrote The Legend of Bagger Vance, which was, of course, turned into a movie with a bunch of no-name actors, Matt Damon, Will Smith, and a woman who transed her kid when it was three. She didn't trans three kids, that was Megan Fox. No, I'm talking about Charlize Theron, who obviously took her role in Monster a little too seriously. But I digress. I was talking about flow state. So in the book, The War of Art, the author tells the story of this famous British author, Maugham, who, when he was asked if he only wrote when he was inspired, he answered in the affirmative, saying, "I write only when inspiration strikes. Fortunately, it strikes every morning at 9 o'clock sharp." And the point of him sharing that quote is to say that a professional doesn't wait for inspiration, but rather he or she sits down to work at a set time every day, regardless of how they feel, emphasizing the importance of establishing a routine and treating your work as a discipline. That's how you become a pro, according to Pressfield. That inspiration reliably follows the act of showing up every day and doing your work. In other words, inspiration isn't a prerequisite for work. Inspiration is what comes from consistently sitting your ass down in a chair and taking care of your business, which just so happens to be what my last guest, Curtis Pelche, said was the best advice he'd ever received, to take care of your business. He said that his junior college coach, Tim Tadlock, used to tell the team that all the time. And Tadlock is now the head baseball coach at Texas Tech. He's been there since 2013. I know you've heard me recommend this book before, but I'm going to do it again because it's that good and because the author is Polish and Poland is where I happen to be. The book is called Flow. It was written by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Say what? I'll spell it and then I'll put it in the show notes. His name is spelled C-S-I-K-S-Z-E-N T-M-I-H-A-L-Y. And it has so much good information in there. I actually recommended it to a female friend of mine who's going through a divorce. I'll share some of his ideas straight from the book, which I have so many highlights in this book. But The book's all about optimal experience and happiness. So one of the quotes, he says, "The happiest people spend much time in a state of flow, the state in which people are so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter. The experience itself is so enjoyable that people will do it even at great cost for the sheer sake of doing it." And this defines flow as complete immersion and joy in the activity itself. A related quote from the book says, "Flow is being completely involved in an activity for its own sake. The ego falls away. Time flies. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz." And there he's describing a vivid description of the flow experience, where your self-consciousness disappears and your perception of time is altered, kind of like when you're praying or meditating or just flowing, having a great time. You wish you could hold on to that good time, but a lot of times it's like trying to hold water in your hand. Here's one that deals with life more generally speaking. He says, "It is by being fully involved with every detail of our lives, whether good or bad, that we find happiness, not by trying to look for it directly." That one's important, and that's why I share it. He's saying you want to engage with life and be present. I remember asking former guest Ted Agon on the pod, who is almost, I think he's about 80 years old, for his best advice. And what he told me was to stay engaged. Two words, stay engaged, which is great advice. He's still sharp and very active. He and his wife go dancing at least once a week. And I hope he'll forgive me if he's not yet 80, but I think that's right. And let me touch on the good or bad. There's very good reason to indulge the bad, to allow yourself to feel the bad times so that you can process the emotion. And to remember that without bad times, there are no good times. You'll only fully appreciate living the good life if you've been through some shit. There's no happiness without unhappiness. I know a few guys in their 20s who tell me they'd love to have a girlfriend, somebody they can call their own, their little boo. And, or maybe that was me wanting that, the latter at least. But they're frustrated in their quest for a suitable mate. And the last thing you want to do when you've been on a bunch of dates with some Gen Z feminazis who think they're better than you is to avoid whatever loneliness you're feeling. I would tell you to embrace it. Why? Because once that sweet tenderoni does come along, and she will, your value is only going up, young king in your 20s. Once she does come into your life, you'll appreciate her that much more. And you'll remember how hard you worked to develop yourself to attract a woman who thinks you hung the moon. Initially, at least. Until she learns, you know, sometimes you don't even notice the garbage is full, or you miss the hamper with your dirty drawers and have to explain to her that, you know, hey, Steph Curry misses a free throw once a week, too. You can be 360 with the wrist, boy, and still miss. It happens. But enough about your marriage. I saw a post on X the other day by somebody called ING Pauline, somewhat related. She said, "How come when I wear a ring, the amount of men checking me out or talking to me is reduced by 80%? But when my man wears a ring, the amount of women checking him out or talking to him doubles. What is wrong with you women?" And the first comment said, "It's because men respect men and women don't respect women." There's a knock at the door. Somebody holding a sink. Somebody let him in. Here's another quote from Flo. It says, "A person can make himself happy or miserable regardless of what is actually happening outside just by changing the contents of consciousness." Makes sense to me. You want to learn to control your inner state. Nobody in this world will upset you without your consent. If somebody succeeds in provoking you, you are complicit. I believe that's from the Stoics. Therefore, you want to fortify your mind, becoming impervious to somebody else's mood. You'll be dealing with others who can't control their emotional state the rest of your life. You may as well start working on yourself now so as to remain unaffected, when it best serves you, at least. And you might ask, well, how do you know when it best serves you to be indifferent? And I would tell you, if you haven't prayed for wisdom and discernment, that's a solid place to start. Like, most things you could do that'll, let's say, lead you to living a bigger life, it's simple, it's easy to do, but easy not to do. Sitting in prayer to ask for wisdom and good judgment, that's easy to do, it's easy not to do. Prayer, meditation, journaling, those are the fundamental blocking and tackling that you need if you're going to ever win a Heisman Trophy. I don't know. Some guys want the personal power that comes from the ability to control your inner state, to gain control over your external circumstances, but they're not willing to put in the work. It takes consistent effort. The three legs I just talked about, prayer, meditation, journaling, you've got to do it consistently. Continuous, unceasing effort. Unceasing is a word, right? I think it is. It's just never come out of my mouth before. It happens quite a bit where I just, something comes out of my mouth and I'm like, I must have read that. I've never said it. Like Vistula River. I don't even know if I said that right. I don't know if that's how they pronounce it. Let's do one more from Flo. It says, people who learn to control inner experience will be able to determine the quality of their lives, which is as close as any of us can come to being happy. I tell my guys all the time, imagine if you couldn't control your thoughts. If God himself appeared to you tomorrow and said, from here on out, you'll no longer have control over your thoughts. Can you imagine the hell that would be? But what does it tell you? That what happens in your mind is largely under your control. Nothing in this life is going to harm you more than your own thoughts. And fortunately, the good Lord gave us some control of that. And I'm reminded of Shad Helmstetter's book. I read this book when I was probably 23 years old. It's called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. Because how many times do you hear people say, I can't stop thinking about whatever, I need a drink. They may as well wear a sign around their neck that says mental midget or mentally and verbally challenged, right? You don't want to say midget if you don't have to. And greater control of your mind will breed greater control of your tongue. You won't slip up and say midget when you don't want to. So be better than me. Be better than that. How successful and happy is the person who can't control their tongue? They're not happy at all. They get in all kinds of trouble. Because usually the person who can't control their tongue is the one doing the complaining. They call it diarrhea of the mouth. I call it being a little bitch. And maybe I'm violating my own advice or breaking one of Robert Greene's 48 laws. Law 4, always say less than necessary. But I said it to emphasize a point and to continue the streak of that being said now 3 episodes in a row. Being a little bitch. I know Curtis mentioned it. He's got a tattoo that says his initials, don't D-B-A-B, don't be a biatch. But this is a really important topic, so let's stay on it. The idea of strengthening your mind and controlling your inner state, your internal state. Goal setting is something I'm a big proponent of, as you know. Do you know why I'm such a big proponent or big fan of goal setting? It's because it works. And it ties into what we're talking about. So I know you're probably familiar with the reticular activator in your brain, which is the part that changes your perceptions based on your circumstances. When you buy the baby blue RAV4 and then you start seeing them everywhere on the road. You know, when I had a Jeep Wrangler in high school, I would bet I didn't miss one that drove by. And part of the reason is we'd always wave to each other. It's the only vehicle I've ever owned where that happened. The bond with other drivers of the same ride. That doesn't happen in a Camry or a RAV4, I imagine. I've never owned a RAV4. But goals help you to control your mind. You have different perceptions when you have the burning desire to achieve a goal. Different perceptions change your thoughts. Your goals enhance your thoughts, makes things come alive, so to speak, in your mind. There's a reason it often feels like the universe is conspiring to help you achieve the freely selected goal you've taken the time to write down. Let me read something related that I thought interesting and thought-provoking. It reads, this is about, let's see, 6 or 7 paragraphs, so bear with me. It says, what you experience as reality is not a direct perception of the world, but a controlled hallucination generated by your brain in darkness. Your consciousness never touches the external world directly. Your brain, sealed within the silent darkness of your skull, receives nothing but electrochemical signals. From this limited noisy data, it constructs a complete virtual reality so convincing that you mistake it for direct perception. Colors, sounds, tastes, even your body's position in space are all sophisticated interpretations manufactured entirely within your neural architecture. This virtual model serves a singular evolutionary purpose: prediction. Your conscious experience is your brain's best guess about what actions will keep you alive. You don't see the world as it is. You see a user interface optimized for survival, where objects appear solid not because they fundamentally are, but because treating them as solid has kept your ancestors alive. The most radical implication lies in what this reveals about the boundary between self and world. The distinction between what is you and what is not you exists only within this hallucination. Your experience of being a separate self moving through an external world is itself a construction, a useful model, but not an ultimate truth. This understanding collapses the apparent division between perception and imagination, between objective and subjective. All experience occurs within the same generative process. Your deepest emotions, your sense of purpose, your connections with others, these aren't reactions to an external reality, but co-creations with it, arising from the same predictive mechanisms that generate your perception of physical objects. The profound freedom in this truth is that your experience is far more malleable than you've been led to believe. The barriers between what you think possible and impossible exist primarily in your predictive model, not in reality itself. When you fully comprehend that your conscious experience is a construction, you gain the capacity to participate more deliberately in its creation. How about that? I don't have anything to add. Word. Word is born. Let's talk U.S. news and money. The Department of Treasury announced that June saw a $27 billion surplus from tariff revenues. So I haven't paid attention to any leftist media since I've been in Europe because I don't need to, right? I'm sure they're all saying Trump was right again and admitting they didn't know what the hell they were talking about when the stock market gave us buying opportunities in April. Remember that? 3 months ago, right? I've had a few of you tell me the stock tips I've given you, that you appreciate them, that you've told me it's made you lots of money. And while I love hearing that, you should know I don't give stock tips. And if I ever mention a stock, I preface it with don't take investment advice from some podcaster gallivanting around the Eurozone. Also, if anybody gives you a stock recommendation, you should know they're not going to be around more than likely to tell you when to sell, usually because they don't know themselves. If you want one of the rules I abide by, and maybe you should too, hold your winners and sell your losers. That's generic advice. That doesn't come from me. But yes, things I've talked about, nuclear energy has done really well. I have a nuclear energy ETF that's done well. It's NUKZ, nukes. It's easy to remember. I've mentioned Tesla, which is up 50% since I put it in the title of an episode earlier this year. What else have I mentioned? VTSAX, I usually mention. If you started investing in VTSAX when we first started talking about equities 5 or so years ago, you would have just about doubled your money. It's up about 90% the last 5 years. VTSAX, since it's not an individual stock, I have no problem touting it as long as you're a long-term investor. But again, that's not investment advice. Don't take investment advice from me. My mention of investments is for entertainment purposes only. If you need a reason to invest, let the terrible taste of inflation we've had recently inspire you. Because over the last 10 years, we've experienced about 35% inflation. And of course, it's skyrocketed in the last, 4 or 5 years since COVID. Meanwhile, the S&P 500, ticker SPY, is up over 250%. Which earlier this month hit another all-time high, its seventh of the year. Last year, the S&P hit 57 all-time highs, which is the fifth most ever. And if you'd taken some risk on individual stocks, especially in the tech sector, oh man, I'll talk about a few of them. Over the last 10 years, Google is up over 500%. Amazon, up over 900%. Apple, almost 700%. Meta, 750%. Microsoft, 1,200%. Netflix, just over 1,200%. And what's Bitcoin done? Up over 40,000% over the last 10 years. I'll talk more about Bitcoin in the future, in the near future, because I know it interests some of you. And though I've long stayed away from talking about cryptocurrencies, maybe it's time to share what I know, tell you what I think. Whether it's digital gold. Gold is up, by the way, too, 175% over the last 10 years. Whether Bitcoin is digital gold or a digital tulip. I keep getting asked by young people if buying a house should be in the cards right now. And when they ask, they usually ask because of interest rates, not because we're living through the most unaffordable housing market in history. Unaffordable now because it takes an income of about $120,000 a year to purchase the median priced home in America, which is somewhere around $350,000, I believe. And I'll tell you what I tell them, which is I wouldn't base my decision on whether to buy a house on interest rates, which have normalized, historically speaking. Interest rates when I was born were near 18%. In the 90s, they were over 8%. And then in the aughts, close to 6%, 2010s. Well, the 2010s were the anomaly because people were stealing houses back in the 2010s. But they're back to, well, what's the latest? Interest rates peaked in October 23 at 7.79%. Now they're sitting at 6 2/3 are interest rates now. So in January 2021, we experienced the lowest 30-year mortgage rates in history. They got down to 2.65%. Free money almost. And as far as this being the most unaffordable housing market, what I would tell you is, despite being a real estate investor and having followed the real estate market closely for over 20 years now, I can't tell you if prices are going to dip. Nobody can. The future is unknowable. As I've always said, if you want somebody to predict the future for you, tell you what the future is going to be, I can refer you to someone, but don't come to me after that and ask, hey, they said that you said they could predict the future. Yeah, they tell you that they can. I can't tell you when prices are going to dip, but if you wouldn't let all-time highs in the stock market prevent you from contributing to your 401ks or investing in stocks, I wouldn't let that stop me from buying a house either. Part of the reason for the housing slump, in addition to what I've already mentioned, is due to the condo market. So according to Charlie Bilello, great follow on X, by the way, there are 80% more condo sellers than buyers. And this is due to surging insurance costs and HOA dues or maintenance fees, whatever you want to call them. Or worse, when they have special assessments where they just throw an extra fee on top of your HOA dues because they need a new roof and didn't do a good job of managing a reserve fund through the years. I once served on an HOA board. People say parenting is a thankless job. No, parenting, you won't receive a lot of thank yous, especially early on. You know, it's interesting, having come from a broken home, having somewhat of a latchkey existence as an adolescent, I should say, and really living with step family and having friends' parents or girlfriends' parents provide for you at times, that matures you in a lot of ways. And one of those ways is I would say thank you a lot, for meals especially. And something I noticed is when I would go to other friends' houses post high school, for example, to eat dinner with their family, there wouldn't be any thank yous toward their parents for this great home cooked meal, which I'm totally a sucker for. And while I thought that was weird, I had to consider whether I would have been like them were I not forced to stay in so many different homes growing up. So anyway, serving on an HOA board, it's the most thankless job I can think of. And I bring that up because when I quote unquote ran for the board, this was over 10 years ago. I was in my early 30s. But the most important part of my pitch to the residents was my intention to control for surging HOA dues and special assessments, especially. And I got the most votes, so they made me the president. So I'll say, like, jury duty, maybe everybody should do it at least once, serve on a jury and serve on an HOA board. But like Congress, there should probably be term limits. There definitely should be term limits. Advice I also give as it pertains to real estate investing is usually you want to stay away from townhomes or condos. And the reasons are what I've just outlined. Insurance costs, although that's happened with single family homes too, but HOA dues cut into your returns considerably. So if you have to pay $300, $400, $800 a month, that comes right off the top. So even if your condo is paid off, let's say you have a $200,000 condo and you can rent it for $2,000 a month, which would be a pretty solid return right now, if you can get it. If your HOA maintenance fees or dues are, let's say, $500 a month, you're looking at $1,500 a month cash flow from your $2,000 gross rent. And then you've got to pay taxes. Usually insurance is included in your maintenance fee, but not always. So you might only be clearing $1,000 a month. Now, the exception would be if you can lease short-term, but usually then you'd have to furnish the place. And on short-term rentals, well, the upside is on short-term rentals, you can usually expect to charge 50 to 100% more on average, but then you'll have frequent turnover and more vacancies. And it'll need to be thoroughly cleaned and restocked every time somebody moves out and somebody else moves back in. But hopefully you can make up for it in what you're able to charge. So all that said, if you're a new real estate investor, townhouses / condos are not the first route I would go. And since I know I have listeners in Houston, over the past year, the median sale year-over-year price change for condos, 8 of the top 10 places that they've decreased in value the most are in Florida, but number 3 on the list, down 23% year-over-year, are condos. The median sale price in Houston is $153,000. Crestview, Florida, $475,000. Oakland, California is the other non-Florida location on the list, down 20.3%, median sales price $510,000. Whoa. So, yeah, I wouldn't start that way. House hack if you can, but buy a house because you want to live in it, and then maybe turn it into a rental later. Have you thought about this? With the unaffordable housing market that we have right now, how many young guys in their 20s who maybe have managed to save 40, 50 grand for a down payment? A lot of them gifted money from their parents. I've seen that a lot. Maybe they're instead buying a half a Bitcoin, which I'm sure you've noticed. It's at an all-time high right now. I think it's over 120,000 a coin. That might leave boomers holding the bag or their house, right? Are there enough of those young people in America to bring prices way down? That'd be a supply-demand issue we've never faced. It's just a thought. Let's wrap up with Epstein, who seems to be the talk of the town. Not here, but back home. What do you think is behind Trump telling his supporters to move on? That it's another Democrat hoax? I have some thoughts. I'll share. One, we know the surveillance video of Epstein's cell was altered. And there's at least 1 minute missing. It might be more than a minute. How convenient is that? Two, why would Trump want supporters to move on after so many people like the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, the Deputy Director of the FBI, Dan Bongino, and some others, they were so adamant that they were going to release the files to us, to the public. Why did they do that? We can't know for sure, but I have theories. First, many assume Epstein was working for the Mossad, which is Israeli intelligence, which I don't know if that's true. What we do know is his former attorney, Alan Dershowitz, says that he wasn't. He wasn't working for the Mossad. That he would know if he was because he was Epstein's attorney. But would someone working in Israeli intelligence tell anybody they're a secret agent? Epstein wasn't a dummy, according to reports. He was buddy-buddy with a bunch of really smart people, scientists, and worked with guys at MIT and Bill Clinton, Bill Gates. I don't know that you get to be friends with really smart people without having some intelligence. No pun intended. And it's obvious now that if Epstein were an intelligence asset, that Dershowitz would be telling us about it. He'd be spilling the beans right now. So now we know why Epstein wouldn't have told him that. Then you have Ghislaine Maxwell, who was, what, his girlfriend or complicit in all of this, evidently. She's serving a 20-year prison sentence. If all this is much ado about nothing, why is she in prison? Who was she arranging young girls for? So there's that. But let me give you some things to think about that I haven't seen anywhere in the media. And that is, why, if this guy got super wealthy from what was supposedly a hedge fund, or he was some big-time investor, why do we not know how the fund performed? What sort of returns was he able to generate? What was the name of the fund? Do we know any of that? Who worked there? Where are the interviews with former employees? I imagine all those interviews are located in the same place as all the interviews conducted with the J6 insurrectionists. You know, the 60 Minutes interviews where they ask, what were you doing at the Capitol that day? Or what was the plan to take over the country? Were you doing a coup, or were you trying to stop a coup, or what you thought was a coup by Democrats? And if you were doing an insurrection, don't you think you would have gotten farther if you at least had a water gun? Once you took over the Capitol with those water guns, would you have, like, how were you going to take the next building? Would you have had enough ammunition? Had you located the water hose? how did Epstein come into hundreds of millions of dollars if he wasn't operating the biggest blackmail operation in the world for intelligence agencies? I don't know. These are all theories. Also, related to Ghislaine Maxwell, did you know that her dad, Robert Maxwell, was suspected of being an intelligence agent for many different governments? Not just one. He had known links to MI6, which is British intelligence, and the KGB, which of course is the Soviet intelligence arm, and the Mossad. And do you know how he died? His body was found floating in the Atlantic. He accidentally fell off his own yacht. Now he's buried in Jerusalem. So if Epstein was able to enrich himself enough to buy one of the more expensive townhomes in Manhattan, to buy a jet, to buy a private island and everything else, you would assume if he was running a sophisticated blackmail operation that those files would be some of the most valuable information in the world. Information that could take down world leaders, potentially. Or at least enable you to own foreign leaders if you wanted to. So who's to say Trump, now that he has his hands on those files, isn't using it for his own purposes? Trump's never been one to leave money on the table. Who's to say he's not using the evidence that he now has to control the British or the Israelis or whoever? Although I don't think that's what he's doing. I'm just saying it's possible. These are all theories. Something else to think about. With Trump saying that we should move on, that it's all another Democrat hoax, do you believe that? Well, one thing I'll say about Trump, for all his leadership skills and persuasive skills, marketing skills, his ability to negotiate, his negotiating skills are like nothing we've ever seen. The man's been skillfully negotiating his entire adult life. So that's what, 60 years of negotiating? He wrote the book on it, The Art of the Deal. Again, I don't think he would leave a powerful piece of leverage on the table if it could benefit him and, by extension, benefit us, benefit Americans. He's the commander-in-chief of the most powerful country in the world, a world that just so happens to have intelligence agencies that have been trying to take him out for the past 8 or 9 years. Would he forego an asset like that, like the results of the most sophisticated blackmail operation run by the world's intelligence agencies who hate him? Would he just give it up? But I was saying, for all Trump's top-notch skills, one thing he's not good at is explaining himself. You remember the fine people thing? The hoax that they had to set up so Biden could be installed or elected or run for office? He said it was the reason he decided to quote-unquote run for president. Trump didn't say, hey, hold up, that's not the full quote. This is all BS. He didn't do that. Another example would be the grab him by the P-word comment, which I've addressed. I addressed it in a previous episode. It was in the title, where I said that he was likely being hyperbolic but directionally correct, as per usual. In that when you're high status, women tend to throw themselves at you, not to mention he was trying to be funny. Remember I used the example of Gene Simmons, an ugly dude who claims to have slept with 20,000 women because he's the lead singer of a band? And that Sarah McLachlan doesn't have groupies lining up outside her tour bus after a concert? If we were a truth-seeking society, that may have started a conversation about why groupies are even a thing. But then you'd be talking about an aspect of female nature, which, of course, was forbidden under the woke era, back when the future was female. You know, before I got married, one of my best friends, who was already married, told me what I would least like about marriage is having to explain myself all the time. So I see a lot of myself in Trump. I always have. Not always. I didn't like him when I was younger. I didn't like how braggadocious he was, putting his name on everything and all that. But the whole not explaining yourself, that might just be a masculine trait, not wanting to explain yourself. And of course, Trump embodies old school masculinity, which of course had been taken off the board for a while there. Many people forgot what masculinity entails. We don't see it much among our youth, that's for sure. But that's one of them, not wanting to explain yourself. And he could do a better job, especially in the position he now holds. I think a lot of men see explaining themselves, such as in the instances I just mentioned. I think many men see it similar to complaining, like, poor me, they're lying about me, or they quoted me out of context, they're trying to lock me in a cage, trying to kill me, poor me. he's none of that. He doesn't do any of that, because he's a man, goddamn. What's another word for complaining? Bitching. And Trump is anything but a little bitch. And that word keeps coming up. Sorry about that. But what he could explain better is why he thinks the Epstein thing is another Democrat hoax, similar to the Russian collusion hoax, which what they did there was fabricated what was needed in an attempt to service their own ends. Intelligence is what they do. It's what they are. It's in the name. They don't call them idiot agencies. So he, Trump, I'm talking about, he may have gotten his hands on this intelligence, the Epstein files, and realized it was all concocted in the interim there when it was determined he was going to be president between the election and the time he took office. Remember how quiet everything was after the election? That might be because they were busy bleach bidding servers and drafting the new Epstein files, different from the old Epstein files, which he's now referring to as a hoax. Although I did just see before I sat to record here that he had said, what did he say? If there's credible information, it should be released. So that's good. And as far as Bondi saying that the Epstein files were sitting on her desk, remember that? That she needed to review it and would release it, whatever she got, which, if I remember correctly, she got from the FBI office in New York, that it may have been all bunk once she got it, when she dug into it. You know, the FBI office in the Southern District of New York, where Comey's daughter is still employed, I believe. Who knows? We'll probably never know. Or, like the JFK files, they'll release them 60 years hence, and we'll realize, hey, the CIA didn't really document their crimes. I think Nicolas Cage had everybody fooled, thinking there was a document somewhere saying, I purchased this gun for Oswald on November 14th, 1963, so he could kill Kennedy on November 22nd at my direction. That was never going to happen. Nor would Epstein write, Dear Diary, this is the list of the rich and powerful men I have managed to blackmail. And next paragraph, these are the crimes I committed today. So don't get your hopes up, friends. I appreciate you listening. Last thing, I've sent a few postcards back to the States these past few weeks, one of them to a guy who left a review on Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy the pod, please leave a review and I will send you a little something in the mail, a small token of my appreciation, because I do appreciate you. And if you're interested in working on with me one-on-one, I do have room for one more. Let me know. That's it. Make today great. I'll check back at you next time. God bless. Thank you, folks.